Chapter 20. The horse who headed this procession was a conscientious creature, and began at once explaining itself in a rather troubled voice. "I hope we have done right, O Yarsa," it said, "but we do not know. We times, but the seventh time something fell off it. We had thought it was the top of his head, but now we saw it was a covering made of the skin of some other creature. Then some said we had done your will with the seven dips, and others said not. In the end, we dipped it seven more times. We hope that was right. The creature talked a lot between the dips, and most between the second seven, but we could not understand it."
"You have done very well, Hnu," said Oyarsa. "Stand away that I may see it, for now I will speak to it."
The guards fell away on each side. Weston's usually pale face, under the bracing influence of the cold water, had assumed the colour of a ripe tomato, and his hair, which had naturally not been cut since he reached Malacandra, was plastered in straight, lank masses across his forehead. A good deal of water was still dripping over his nose and ears. His expression, unfortunately wasted on an audience ignorant of terrestrial physiognomy, was that of a brave man suffering in a great cause, and rather eager than reluctant to face the worst, or even to provoke it. In explanation of his conduct, it is only fair to remember that he had already that morning endured all the terrors of an expected martyrdom, and all the anticlimax of 14 compulsory cold douches. Divine, who knew his man, shouted out to Weston in English, "Steady, Weston. These devils can split the atom or something pretty like it. Be careful what you say to them, and don't let's have any of your bloody nonsense."
"Ah," said Weston, "so you've gone native too."
"Be silent," said the voice of Oyarsa. "You, thick one, have told me nothing of yourself, so I will tell it to you. In your own world you have attained great wisdom concerning bodies, and by this you have been able to make a ship that can cross the heaven. But in all other things you have the mind of an animal. When first you came here, I sent for you, meaning you nothing but honour. The darkness in your own mind filled you with fear. Because you thought I meant evil to you, you went as a beast goes against a beast of some other kind, and snared this ransom. You would give him up to the evil you feared. Today, seeing him here to save your own life, you would have given him to me a second time, still thinking I meant him hurt. These are your dealings with your own kind, and what you intend to my people I know. Already you have killed some, and you have come here to kill them all. To you it is nothing whether a creature is now or not. At first I thought this was because you cared only whether a creature had a body like your own. But Ransom has that, and you would kill him as lightly as any of my now. I did not know that the Bent One had done so much in your world, and still I do not understand it. If you were mine, I would unbody you even now. Do not think follies. By my hand, Maleldil does greater things than this, and I can unmake you even on the borders of your own world's air. But I do not yet resolve to do this. It is for you to speak. Let me see if there is anything in your mind besides fear and death and desire." Weston turned to Ransom. "I see," he said, "that you have chosen the most momentous crisis in the history of the human race to betray it." Then he turned in the direction of the voice.
"I know you kill us," he said. "Me not afraid. Others come. Make it our world." But Divine had jumped to his feet and interrupted him.
"No, no, Oyarsa," he shouted. "You no listen him. He very foolish man. He have dreams. We little people only want pretty sunbloods. You give us plenty sunbloods, we go back into sky. You never see us no more. All done, see?"
"Silence," said Oyarsa.
There was an almost imperceptible change in the light, if it could be called light, out of which the voice came, and Divine crumpled up and fell back on the ground. When he resumed his sitting position, he was white and panting.
"Speak on," said Oyarsa to Weston. "Me no, began Weston in Malacandrian, and then broke off. "I can't say what I want in their accursed language," he said in English.
"Speak to Ransom, and he shall turn it into our speech," said Oyarsa. Weston accepted the arrangement at once. He believed that the hour of his death was come, and he was determined to utter the thing, almost the only thing outside his own science, which he had to say. He cleared his throat. Almost he struck a gesture and began, "To you I may seem a vulgar robber,
but I bear on my shoulders the destiny of the human race. Your tribal life with its Stone Age weapons and beehive huts, its primitive coracles and elementary social structure, has nothing to compare with our civilization, with our science, medicine, and law, our armies, our architecture, our commerce, and our transport system, which is rapidly annihilating space and time. Our right to supersede you is the right of the higher over the lower. Life...
Half a moment, said Ransom in English. That's about as much as I can manage at one go.
Then, turning to Oyarsa, he began translating as well as he could. The process was difficult, and the result, which he felt to be rather unsatisfactory, was something like this. Among us, Oyarsa, there is a kind of Hnau who will take another Hnau's food and things when they are not looking. He says he is not an ordinary one of that kind. He says what he does now will make very different things happen to those of our people who are not yet born. He says that, among you, Hnau of one kindred all live together, and the Hrossa have spears like those we used a very long time ago, and your huts are small and round, and your boats small and light, and like our old ones, and you have only one ruler. He says it is different with us. He says we know much. There is a thing happens in our world when the body of a living creature feels pains and becomes weak, and he says we sometimes know how to stop it. He says we have many bent people, and we kill them, or shut them in huts, and that we have people for settling quarrels between the bent Hnau about their huts and mates and things. He says we have many ways for the Hnau of one land to kill those of another, and some are trained to do it. He says we build very big and strong huts of stones and other things, like the Fifeltrigi. And he says we exchange many things among ourselves, and can carry heavy weights very quickly a long way. Because of all this, he says it would not be the act of a bent Hnau if our people killed all your people. As soon as Ransom finished, Weston continued. Life is greater than any system of morality. Her claims are absolute. It is not by tribal taboos and copybook maxims that she has pursued her relentless march from the amoeba to man and from man to civilization. He says, began Ransom, that living creatures are stronger than the question whether an act is bent or good. No, that cannot be right. He says it is better to be alive and bent than to be dead. No, he says, I cannot say what he says, Oyarsa, in your language. But he goes on to say that the only good thing is that there should be very many creatures alive. He says there were many other animals before the first men, and the later ones were better than the earlier ones. But he says the animals were not born because of what is said to the young about bent and good action by their elders. And he says these animals did not feel any pity. She, began Weston.
I'm sorry, interrupted Ransom, but I've forgotten who she is.
Life, of course, snapped Weston.
She has ruthlessly broken down all obstacles and liquidated all failures, and today, in her highest form, civilized man, and in me, as his representative, she presses forward to that interplanetary leap which will, perhaps, place her forever beyond the reach of death.
He says, resumed Ransom, that these animals learned to do many difficult things, except those who could not, and those ones died, and the other animals did not pity them. And he says the best animal now is the kind of man who makes the big huts and carries the heavy weights and does all the other things I told you about. And he is one of these, and he says that if the others all knew what he was doing, they would be pleased. He says that if he could kill you all and bring our people to live in Malakandra, then they might be able to go on living here after something had gone wrong with our world. And then, if something went wrong with Malakandra, they might go and kill all the Hnau in another world, and then another, and so they would never die out.
It is in her right, said Weston, the right, or, if you will, the might of life herself, that I am prepared without flinching to plant the flag of man on the soil of Malakandra, to march on step by step, see forms of life that we find, claiming planet after planet, system after system, till our posterity, whatever strange form and yet unguessed mentality they have assumed, dwell in the universe wherever the universe is habitable.
He says, translated Ransom, that because of this it would not be a bent action. Or else, he says, it would be a possible action for him to kill you all and bring us here. He says he would feel no pity. He is saying again that perhaps they would be able to keep moving from one world to another, and wherever they came they would kill everyone. I think he is now talking about worlds that go around other suns. He wants the creatures born from us to be in as many places as they can. He says he does not know what kind of creatures they will be. I may fall, said Weston, but while I live I will not, with such a key in my hand, consent to close the gates of the future on my race. What lies in that future, beyond our present ken, passes imagination to conceive. It is enough for me that there is a beyond. He is saying, Ransom translated, that he will not stop trying to do all this unless you kill him. And he says that though he doesn't know what will happen to the creatures sprung from us, he wants it to happen very much. Weston, who had now finished his statement, looked round instinctively for a chair to sink into. On Earth he usually sank into a chair as the applause began. Finding none, he was not the kind of man to sit on the ground like Divine, he folded his arms and stared with a certain dignity about him. "It is well that I have heard you," said Oyasa, "for though your mind is feebler, your will is less bent than I thought. It is not for yourself that you would do all this." No, said Weston proudly in Malachandrian. Me die, man live. Yet you know that these creatures would have to be made quite unlike you before they lived on other worlds. Yes, yes, all new. No one know yet. Strange, big. Then it is not the shape of body that you love. No, me no care how they shaped. One would think, then, that it is for the mind you care. But that cannot be, or you would love now wherever you met it. No care for now, care for man. But if it is neither man's mind, which is as the mind of all other now, is not Maleldil maker of them all, nor his body, which will change, if you care for neither of these, what do you mean by man? This had to be translated to Weston. When he understood it, he replied, Me care for man, care for our race, what man begets. He had to ask Ransom the words for race and beget. Strange, said Oyarsa, you do not love any one of your race. You would have let me kill Ransom. You do not love the mind of your race, nor the body. Any kind of creature will please you if only it is begotten by your kind as they now are. It seems to me, thick one, that what you really love is no completed creature, but the very seed itself, for that is all that is left. Tell him, said Weston, when he had been made to understand this, that I don't pretend to be a metaphysician. I have not come here to chop logic. If he cannot understand, as apparently you can't either, anything so fundamental as a man's loyalty to humanity, I can't make him understand it. But Ransom was unable to translate this, and the voice of Oyasa continued. I see now how the Lord of the Silent World has bent you. There are laws that all now know of pity and straight dealing and shame and the like. And one of these is the love of kindred. He has taught you to break all of them except this one, which is not one of the greatest laws. This one he has bent till it becomes folly, and has set it up, thus bent, to be a little blind Oyarsa in your brain. And now you can do nothing but obey it, though if we ask you why it is a law, you give no other reason for it than for all the other and greater laws which it drives you to disobey. Do you know why he has done this? Me think no such person, me wise, new man, no believe all that old talk. I will tell you. He has left you this one because a bent now can do more evil than a broken one. He has only bent you, but this thin one who sits on the ground he has broken, for he has left him nothing but greed. He is now only a talking animal, and in my world he could do no more evil than an animal. If he were mine, I would unmake his body, for the now in it is already dead. But if you were mine, I would try to cure you. Tell me, thick one, why did you come here? Me tell you, make man live all the time. But are your wise men so ignorant as not to know that Malachandra is older than your own world and nearer its death? Most of it is dead already. My people live only in the Hundramits. The heat and the water have been more and will be less. Soon now, very soon, I will end my world and give back my people to Maleldil. Me know all that plenty. This only first try. Soon they go on another world. But do you not know that all worlds will die? Men go jump off each before it deads, on and on, see? And when all are dead? Weston was silent. After a time, Oyarsa spoke again. Do you not ask why my people, whose world is old, have not rather come to yours and taken it long ago?
Oh, said Weston, you not know how.
You are wrong, said Oyarsa. Many thousands of thousand years before this, when nothing yet lived on your world, the cold death was coming on my Harandra. Then I was in deep trouble, not chiefly for the death of my Hnau. Maleldil does not make them long livers, but for the things which the lord of your world, who was not yet bound, put into their minds. He would have made them, as your people are now, wise enough to see the death of their kind approaching, but not wise enough to endure it. Bent councils would soon have risen among them. They were well able to have made skyships. By me Maleldil stopped them. Some I cured, some I unbodied.
And see what come, interrupted Weston. You now very few, shut up in Handramitz, soon all die.
Yes, said Oyarsa. But one thing we left behind us on the Harandra. Fear. And with fear, murder and rebellion. The weakest of my people does not fear death. It is the Bent One, the lord of your world, who wastes your lives and befouls them with flying from what you know will overtake you in the end. If you were subject of Maleldil, you would have peace. Weston writhed in the exasperation born of his desire to speak and his ignorance of the language.
Trash! Defeatist trash! He shouted at Oyarsa in English.
Then, drawing himself up to his full height, he added in Malacandrian,
You say your Maleldil let all go dead. Other one, Bent One, he fight, jump, live, not all talky-talky. Me no care, Maleldil, like Bent One better, me on his side.
But do you not see that he never will nor can, began Oyarsa, and then broke off, as if recollecting himself. But I must learn more of your world from Ransom, and for that I need till night. I will not kill you, not even the Thin One, for you are out of my world. Tomorrow you shall go hence again in your ship.
Divine's face suddenly fell. He began talking rapidly in English. For God's sake, Weston, make him understand. We've been here for months. The earth is not in opposition now. Tell him it can't be done. He might as well kill us at once.
How long will your journey be to Tholkandra? Asked Oyarsa. Weston, using Ransom as his interpreter, explained that the journey, in the present position of the two planets, was almost impossible. The distance had increased by millions of miles. The angle of their course to the solar rays would be totally different from that which he had counted upon. Even if by a hundredth chance they could hit the earth, it was almost certain that their supply of oxygen would be exhausted long before they arrived.
"Tell him to kill us now," he added.
"All this I know," said Oyarsa. "And if you stay in my world, I must kill you. No such creature will I suffer in Malacandra. I know there is small chance of your reaching your world, but small is not the same as none. Between now and the next moon, choose which you will take. In the meantime, tell me this. If you reach it at all, what is the most time you will need?" After a prolonged calculation, Weston, in a shaken voice, replied that if they had not made it in 90 days, they would never make it, and they would, moreover, be dead of suffocation.
90 days you shall have, said Oyarsa. My Sorns and Fifeltrigi will give you air. We also have that art, and food, for 90 days. But they will do something else to your ship. I am not minded that it should return into the heaven if once it reaches Tholkandra. You, Thick One, were not here when I unmade my dead Hrossa whom you killed. The Thin One will tell you. This I can do, as Maleldil has taught me, over a gap of time or a gap of place. Before your skyship rises, my Sorns will have so dealt with it that on the 90th day it will unbody. It will become what you call nothing. If that day finds it in heaven, your death will be no bitterer because of this. But do not tarry in your ship if once you touch Tholkandra. Now lead these two away, and do you, my children, go where you will. But I must talk with Ransom.
Chapter 21. All that afternoon Ransom remained alone answering Oyarsa's questions. I am not allowed to record this conversation, beyond saying that the voice concluded it with the words, "You have shown me more wonders than are known in the whole of heaven." After that they discussed Ransom's own future. He was given full liberty to remain in Malacandra or to attempt the desperate voyage to Earth. The problem was agonizing to him. In the end, he decided to throw in his lot with Weston and Divine. "Love of our own kind," he said, "is not the greatest of laws, but you, Oyarsa, have said it is a law. If I cannot live in Tholkandra, it is better for me not to live at all."
"You have chosen rightly," said Oyarsa,
"and I will tell you two things. My people will take all the strange weapons out of the ship, but they will give one to you. And the Eldila of Deep Heaven will be about your ship till it reaches the air of Tholkandra, and often in it. They will not let the other two kill you." It had not occurred to Ransom before that his own murder might be one of the first expedients for economizing food and oxygen which would occur to Weston and Divine. He was now astonished at his obtuseness, and thanked Oyarsa for his protective measures. Then the great Eldil dismissed him with these words, "You are guilty of no evil, Ransom of Tholkandra, except a little fearfulness. For that, the journey you go on is your pain, and perhaps your cure. For you must be either mad or brave before it is ended. But I lay also a command on you. You must watch this Weston and this Divine in Tholkandra if ever you arrive there. They may yet do much evil in and beyond your world. From what you have told me, I begin to see that there are Eldila who go down into your air, into the very stronghold of the Bent One. Your world is not so fast shut as was thought in these parts of heaven. Watch those two Bent Ones. Be courageous, fight them. And when you have need, some of our people will help. Meleldil will show them to you. It may even be that you and I shall meet again while you are still in the body. For it is not without the wisdom of Meleldil that we have met now, and I have learned so much of your world. It seems to me that this is the beginning of more comings and goings between the heavens and the worlds, and between one world and another, though not such as the Thick One hoped. I am allowed to tell you this. The year we are now in, but heavenly years are not as yours, has long been prophesied as a year of stirrings and high changes, and the siege of Tholkandra may be near its end. Great things are on foot. If Meleldil does not forbid me, I will not hold aloof from them. And now, farewell." It was through vast crowds of all the Malachandrian species that the three human beings embarked next day on their terrible journey. Weston was pale and haggard from a night of calculations, intricate enough to tax any mathematician, even if his life did not hang on them. Divine was noisy, reckless, and a little hysterical. His whole view of Malachandra had been altered overnight by the discovery that the natives had an alcoholic drink, and he had even been trying to teach them to smoke. Only the Fifeltriggy had made much of it. He was now consoling himself for an acute headache and the prospect of a lingering death by tormenting Weston. Neither partner was pleased to find that all the weapons had been removed from the spaceship, but in other respects everything was as they wished it. At about an hour after noon, Ransom took a last long look at the blue waters, purple forest, and remote green walls of the familiar Handramit, and followed the other two through the manhole. Before it was closed, Weston warned them that they must economize air by absolute stillness. No unnecessary movement must be made during their voyage. Even talking must be prohibited. "I shall speak only in an emergency," he said. "Well, thank God for that, anyway," was Divine's last shot. Then they screwed themselves in. Ransom went at once to the lower side of the sphere, into the chamber which was now most completely upside down, and stretched himself on what would later become its skylight. He was surprised to find that they were already thousands of feet up. The Handramit was only a straight purple line across the rose-red surface of the Harandra. They were above the junction of two Handramits. One of them was doubtless that in which he had lived, the other that which contained Meldilorn. The gully by which he had cut off the corner between the two on Orgre's shoulders was quite invisible. Each minute more Handramits came into view. Long, straight lines, some parallel, some intersecting, some building triangles. The landscape became increasingly geometrical. The waste between the purple lines appeared perfectly flat. The rosy colour of the petrified forests accounted for its tint immediately below him. But to the north and east, the great sand deserts of which the Sorns had told him were now appearing as illimitable stretches of yellow and ochre. To the west, a huge discoloration began to show. It was an irregular patch of greenish-blue that looked as if it were sunk below the level of the surrounding Harandra. He concluded it was the forest lowland of the Fifeltrigi, or rather one of their forest lowlands, for now similar patches were appearing in all directions, some of them mere blobs at the intersection of Handramit, some of vast extent. He became vividly conscious that his knowledge of Malakandra was minute, local, parochial. It was as if a Sorn had journeyed 40 million miles to the earth and spent his stay there between Worthing and Brighton. He reflected that he would have very little to show for his amazing voyage if he survived it. A smattering of the language, a few landscapes, some half-understood physics. But where were the statistics, the history, the broad survey of extraterrestrial conditions, which such a traveller ought to bring back? Those Handramits, for example, seen from the height which the spaceship had now attained in all their unmistakable geometry, they put to shame his original impression that they were natural valleys. They were gigantic feats of engineering, about which he had learned nothing. Feats accomplished, if all were true, before human history began, before animal history began. Or was that only mythology? He knew it would seem like mythology when he got back to Earth, if he ever got back, but the presence of Oyarsa was still too fresh a memory to allow him any real doubts. It even occurred to him that the distinction between history and mythology might itself be meaningless outside the earth. The thought baffled him, and he turned again to the landscape below, the landscape which became every moment less of a landscape and more of a diagram. By this time, to the east, a much larger and darker patch of discoloration than he had yet seen was pushing its way into the reddish ochre of the Malakandrian world. A curiously shaped patch with long arms or horns extending on each side and a sort of bay between them, like the concave side of a crescent. It grew and grew. The wide dark arms seemed to be spread out to engulf the whole planet. Suddenly he saw a bright point of light in the middle of this dark patch and realized that it was not a patch on the surface of the planet at all, but the black sky showing behind her. The smooth curve was the edge of her disk. At this, for the first time since their embarkation, fear took hold of him. Slowly, yet not too slowly for him to see, the dark arms spread farther and even farther round the lighted surface till at last they met. The whole disk, framed in blackness, was before him. The faint percussions of the meteorites had long been audible. The window through which he was gazing was no longer definitely beneath him. His limbs, though already very light, were almost too stiff to move, and he was very hungry. He looked at his watch. He had been at his post, spellbound, for nearly 8 hours. He made his way with difficulty to the sunward side of the ship, and reeled back, almost blinded with the glory of the light. Groping, he found his darkened glasses in his old cabin, and got himself food and water. Weston had rationed them strictly in both. He opened the door of the control room and looked in. Both the partners, their faces drawn with anxiety, were seated before a kind of metal table. It was covered with delicate, gently vibrating instruments in which crystal and fine wire were the predominant materials. Both ignored his presence. For the rest of the silent journey, he was free of the whole ship. When he returned to the dark side, the world they were leaving hung in the star-strewn sky, not much bigger than our earthly moon. Its colours were still visible, a reddish-yellow disk blotched with greenish-blue and capped with white at the poles. He saw the two tiny Malakandrian moons, their movement quite perceptible, and reflected that they were among the thousand things he had not noticed during his sojourn there. He slept and woke, and saw the disk still hanging in the sky. It was smaller than the moon now. Its colours were gone, except for a faint, uniform tinge of redness in its light. Even the light was not now incomparably stronger than that of the countless stars which surrounded it. It had ceased to be Malakandra. It was only Mars. He soon fell back into his old routine of sleeping and basking, punctuated with the making of some scribbled notes for his Malakandrian dictionary. He knew that there was very little chance of his being able to communicate his new knowledge to man, that unrecorded death in the depth of space would almost certainly be the end of their adventure. but already it had become impossible to think of it as space. Some moments of cold fear he had, but each time they were shorter and more quickly swallowed up in a sense of awe which made his personal fate seem wholly insignificant. He could not feel that they were an island of life journeying through an abyss of death. He felt almost the opposite, that life was waiting outside the little iron eggshell in which they rode, ready at any moment to break in, and that, if it killed them, it would kill them by excess of its vitality. He hoped passionately that if they were to perish, they would perish by the unbodying of the spaceship, and not by suffocation within it. To be let out, to be free, to dissolve into the ocean of eternal noon, seemed to him at certain moments a consummation even more desirable than their return to Earth. And if he had felt some such lift of the heart when first he passed through heaven on their outward journey, he felt it now tenfold, for now he was convinced that the abyss was full of life in the most literal sense, full of living creatures. His confidence in Oyarsa's words about the Eldila increased rather than diminished as they went on. He saw none of them. The intensity of light in which the ship swam allowed none of the fugitive variations which would have betrayed their presence. But he heard, or thought he heard, all kinds of delicate sound, or vibrations akin to sound, mixed with the tinkling rain of meteorites. And often the sense of unseen presences even within the spaceship became irresistible. It was this, more than anything else, that made his own chances of life seem so unimportant. He and all his race showed small and ephemeral against a background of such immeasurable fullness. His brain reeled at the thought of the true population of the universe, the three-dimensional infinitude of their territory, and the unchronicled eons of their past. But his heart became steadier than it had ever been. It was well for him that he had reached this frame of mind before the real hardships of their journey began. Ever since their departure from Malacandra, the thermometer had steadily risen. Now it was higher than it had stood at any time on their outward journey. And it still rose. The light also increased. Under his glasses he kept his eyes habitually tight shut, opening them only for the shortest time for necessary movements. He knew that if he reached Earth it would be with permanently damaged sight. But all this was nothing to the torment of heat. All three of them were awake for 24 hours out of the 24, enduring with dilated eyeballs, blackened lips, and froth-flecked cheeks the agony of thirst. It would be madness to increase their scanty rations of water, madness even to consume air in discussing the question. He saw well enough what was happening. In his last bid for life, Weston was venturing inside the Earth's orbit, leading them nearer the sun than man, perhaps than life, had ever been. Presumably this was unavoidable. One could not follow a retreating Earth round the rim of its own wheeling course. They must be trying to meet it, to cut across. It was madness. But the question did not much occupy his mind. It was not possible for long to think of anything but thirst. One thought of water. Then one thought of thirst. Then one thought of thinking of thirst. Then of water again. And still the thermometer rose. The walls of the ship were too hot to touch. It was obvious that a crisis was approaching. In the next few hours it must kill them or get less. It got less. There came a time when they lay exhausted and shivering in what seemed the cold, though it was still hotter than any terrestrial climate. Weston had so far succeeded. He had risked the highest temperature at which human life could theoretically survive, and they had lived through it. But they were not the same men. Hitherto, Weston had slept very little, even in his watches off. Always, after an hour or so of uneasy rest, he had returned to his charts and to his endless, almost despairing calculations. You could see him fighting the despair, pinning his terrified brain down and again down to the figures. Now he never looked at them. He even seemed careless in the control room. Divine moved and looked like a somnambulist. Ransom lived increasingly on the dark side, and for long hours he thought of nothing. Although the first great danger was past, none of them, at this time, had any serious hope of a successful issue to their journey. They had now been 50 days without speech in their steel shell, and the air was already very bad. Weston was so unlike his old self that he even allowed Ransom to take his share in the navigation. Mainly by signs, but with the help of a few whispered words, he taught him all that was necessary at this stage of the journey. Apparently they were racing home, but with little chance of reaching it in time, before some sort of cosmic trade wind. A few rules of thumb enabled Ransom to keep the star which Weston pointed out to him in its position at the center of the skylight, but always with his left hand on the bell to Weston's cabin. This star was not the Earth. The days, the purely theoretical days which bore such a desperately practical meaning for the travellers, mounted to 58 before Weston changed course, and a different luminary was in the centre. 60 days, and it was visibly a planet. 66, and it was like a planet seen through field glasses. 70, and it was like nothing that Ransom had ever seen, a little dazzling disk too large for a planet and far too small for the moon. Now that he was navigating, his celestial mood was shattered. Wild, animal thirst for life, mixed with homesick longing for the free airs and the sights and smells of Earth, for grass and meat and beer and tea and the human voice, awoke in him. At first, his chief difficulty on watch had been to resist drowsiness. Now, though the air was worse, feverish excitement kept him vigilant. Often, when he came off duty, he found his right arm stiff and sore. For hours he had been pressing it unconsciously against the control board, as if his puny thrust could spur the spaceship to yet greater speed. Now they had 20 days to go. 19, 18. And on the white terrestrial disk, now a little larger than a sixpence, he thought he could make out Australia and the southeast corner of Asia. Hour after hour, though the markings moved slowly across the disk with the Earth's diurnal revolution, the disk itself refused to grow larger. "Get on! Get on!" Ransom muttered to the ship. Now 10 days were left, and it was like the moon, and so bright that they could not look steadily at it. The air in their little sphere was ominously bad, but Ransom and Divine risked a whisper as they changed watches. "We'll do it," they said. "We'll do it yet." On the 87th day, when Ransom relieved Divine, he thought there was something wrong with the Earth. Before his watch was done, he was sure. It was no longer a true circle, but bulging a little on one side. It was almost pear-shaped. When Weston came on duty, he gave one glance at the skylight, rang furiously on the bell for Divine, thrust Ransom aside, and took the navigating seat. His face was the colour of putty. He seemed to be about to do something to the controls, but as Divine entered the room, he looked up and shrugged his shoulders with a gesture of despair. Then he buried his face in his hands and laid his head down on the control board. Ransom and Divine exchanged glances. They bundled Weston out of his seat. He was crying like a child, and Divine took his place. And now, at last, Ransom understood the mystery of the bulging Earth. What had appeared as a bulge on one side of her disk was becoming increasingly distinct as a second disk, a disk almost as large in appearance as her own. It was covering more than half of the Earth. It was the moon between them and the Earth, and 240,000 miles nearer. Ransom did not know what fate this might mean for the spaceship. Divine obviously did, and never had he appeared so admirable. His face was as pale as Weston's, but his eyes were clear and preternaturally bright. He sat crouched over the controls like an animal about to spring, and he was whistling very softly between his teeth. Hours later, Ransom understood what was happening. The moon's disk was now larger than the Earth's, and very gradually it became apparent to him that both disks were diminishing in size. The spaceship was no longer approaching either the Earth or the moon. It was farther away from them than it had been half an hour ago, and that was the meaning of Divine's feverish activity with the controls. It was not merely that the moon was crossing their path and cutting them off from the Earth. Apparently, for some reason, probably gravitational, it was dangerous to get too close to the moon, and Divine was standing off into space. In sight of harbour, they were being forced to turn back to the open sea. He glanced up at the chronometer. It was the morning of the 88th day. 2 days to make the Earth, and they were moving away from her. "I suppose this finishes us," he whispered. "Expect so," whispered Divine, without looking round. Weston presently recovered sufficiently to come back and stand beside Divine. There was nothing for Ransom to do. He was sure now that they were soon to die. With this realization, the agony of his suspense suddenly disappeared. Death, whether it came now or some 30 years later on Earth, rose up and claimed his attention. There were preparations a man likes to make. He left the control room and returned into one of the sunward chambers, into the indifference of the moveless light, the warmth, the silence, and the sharp-cut shadows. Nothing was farther from his mind than sleep. It must have been the exhausted atmosphere which made him drowsy. He slept. He awoke in almost complete darkness, in the midst of a loud, continuous noise, which he could not at first identify. It reminded him of something, something he seemed to have heard in a previous existence. It was a prolonged drumming noise close above his head. Suddenly his heart gave a great leap. "Oh, God," he sobbed. "Oh, God, it's rain." He was on Earth. The air was heavy and stale about him, but the choking sensations he had been suffering were gone. He realized that he was still in the spaceship. The others, in fear of its threatened unbodying, had characteristically abandoned it the moment it touched Earth and left him to his fate. It was difficult in the dark and under the crushing weight of terrestrial gravity to find his way out, but he managed it. He found the manhole and slithered, drinking great draughts of air, down the outside of the sphere, slipped in mud, blessed the smell of it, and at last raised the unaccustomed weight of his body to its feet. He stood in pitch-black night under torrential rain. With every pore of his body he drank it in. With every desire of his heart he embraced the smell of the field about him, a patch of his native planet where grass grew, where cows moved, where presently he would come to hedges and a gate. He had walked about half an hour when a vivid light behind him and a strong, momentary wind informed him that the spaceship was no more. He felt very little interest. He had seen dim lights, the lights of men, ahead. He contrived to get into a lane, then into a road, then into a village street. A lighted door was open. There were voices from within, and they were speaking English. There was a familiar smell. He pushed his way in, regardless of the surprise he was creating, and walked to the bar. "A pint of bitter, please," said Ransom. Chapter 22, The Last Chapter. At this point, if I were guided by purely literary considerations, my story would end. But it is time to remove the mask and to acquaint the reader with the real and practical purpose for which this book has been written. At the same time, he will learn how the writing of it became possible at all. Dr. Ransom, and at this stage it will become obvious that that is not his real name, soon abandoned the idea of his Malachandrian dictionary, and indeed all idea of communicating his story to the world. He was ill for several months, and when he recovered, he found himself in considerable doubt as to whether what he remembered had really occurred. It looked very like a delusion produced by his illness, and most of his apparent adventures could, he saw, be explained psychoanalytically. He did not lean very heavily on this fact himself, for he had long since observed that a good many real things in the fauna and flora of our own world could be accounted for in the same way, if you started with the assumption that they were illusions. But he felt that if he himself half doubted his own story, the rest of the world would disbelieve it completely. He decided to hold his tongue, and there the matter would have rested, but for a very curious coincidence. This is where I come into the story. I had known Dr. Ransom slightly for several years, and corresponded with him on literary and philological subjects, though we very seldom met. It was, therefore, quite in the usual order of things that I should write him a letter some months ago, of which I will quote the relevant paragraph. It ran like this. "I am now working at the Platonists of the 12th century, and incidentally discovering that they wrote damnably difficult Latin. In one of them, Bernardus Silvestris, there is a word I should particularly like your views on, the word Oyarses. It occurs in the description of a voyage through the heavens, and an Oyarses seems to be the intelligence or tutelary spirit of a heavenly sphere, i.e., in our language, of a planet. I asked C.J. about it, and he says it ought to be Usiakis. That, of course, would make sense, but I do not feel quite satisfied. Have you by any chance ever come across a word like Oyarses, or can you hazard any guess as to what language it may be? The immediate result of this letter was an invitation to spend a weekend with Dr. Ransom. He told me his whole story, and since then he and I have been almost continuously at work on the mystery. A good many facts, which I have no intention of publishing at present, have fallen into our hands. Facts about planets in general, and about Mars in particular. Facts about medieval Platonists, and, not least in importance, facts about the professor to whom I am giving the fictitious name of Weston. A systematic report of these facts might, of course, be given to the civilized world, but that would almost certainly result in universal incredulity and in a libel action from Weston. At the same time, we both feel that we cannot be silent. We are being daily confirmed in our belief that the Oyarses of Mars was right when it said that the present celestial year was to be a revolutionary one, that the long isolation of our own planet is nearing its end, and that great doings are on foot. We have found reason to believe that the medieval Platonists were living in the same celestial year as ourselves, in fact, that it began in the 12th century of our era, and that the occurrence of the name Oyarsa, Latinized as Oyarses in Bernardus Silvestris, is not an accident. And we have also evidence, increasing almost daily, that Weston, or the force or forces behind Weston, will play a very important part in the events of the next few centuries, and, unless we prevent them, a very disastrous one. We do not mean that they are likely to invade Mars. Our cry is not merely, hands off Malacandra. The dangers to be feared are not planetary, but cosmic, or at least solar, and they are not temporal, but eternal. More than this it would be unwise to say. It was Dr. Ransom who first saw that our only chance was to publish in the form of fiction what would certainly not be listened to as fact. He even thought, greatly overrating my literary powers, that this might have the incidental advantage of reaching a wider public, and that, certainly, it would reach a great many people sooner than Weston. To my objection that, if accepted as fiction, it would for that very reason be regarded as false, he replied that there would be indications enough in the narrative for the few readers, the very few, who at present were prepared to go further into the matter. And they, he said, will easily find out you or me, and will easily identify Weston. Anyway, he continued, what we need for the moment is not so much a body of belief as a body of people familiarized with certain ideas. If we could even effect in 1% of our readers a changeover from the conception of space to the conception of heaven, we should have made a beginning. What neither of us foresaw was the rapid march of events which was to render the book out of date before it was published. These events have already made it rather a prologue to our story than the story itself. But we must let it go as it stands. For the later stages of the adventure, well, it was Aristotle, long before Kipling, who taught us the formula, that is another story. Postscript. Being extracts from a letter written by the original of Dr. Ransom to the author. I think you are right, and after the 2 or 3 corrections marked in red, the manuscript will have to stand. I won't deny that I am disappointed, but then any attempt to tell such a story is bound to disappoint the man who has really been there. I am not now referring to the ruthless way in which you have cut down all the philological part, though, as it stands, we are giving our readers a mere caricature of the Malacandrian language. I mean something more difficult, something which I couldn't possibly express. How can one get across the Malacandrian smells? Nothing comes back to me more vividly in my dreams, especially the early morning smell in those purple woods, where the very mention of early morning and woods is misleading because it must set you thinking of earth and moss and cobwebs and the smell of our planet. But I'm thinking of something totally different, more aromatic, yes. But then it is not hot or luxurious or exotic as that word suggests. Something aromatic, spicy, yet very cold, very thin, tingling at the back of the nose. Something that did to the sense of smell what high, sharp violin notes do to the ear. And, mixed with that, I always hear the sound of the singing, great hollow hound-like music from enormous throats, deeper than Chaliapin, a warm, dark noise. I am homesick for my old Malacandrian valley when I think of it. Yet God knows when I heard it there, I was homesick enough for the earth. Of course, you are right. If we are to treat it as a story, you must telescope the time I spent in the village, during which nothing happened. But I grudge it. Those quiet weeks, the mere living among the Hrossa, are to me the main thing that happened. I know them, Lewis. That's what you can't get into a mere story. For instance, because I always take a thermometer with me on a holiday, it has saved many a one from being spoiled, I know that the normal temperature of a Hross is 103 degrees. I know, though I can't remember learning it, that they live about 80 Martian years, or 160 Earth years, that they marry at about 20, equals 40, that their droppings, like those of the horse, are not offensive to themselves or to me, and are used for agriculture, that they don't shed tears or blink, that they do get, as you would say, elevated but not drunk on a gaudy night, of which they have many. But what can one do with these scraps of information? I merely analyze them out of a whole living memory that can never be put into words, and no one in this world will be able to build up from such scraps quite the right picture. For example, can I make even you understand how I know, beyond all question, why it is that the Malachandrians don't keep pets, and, in general, don't feel about their lower animals as we do about ours? Naturally, it is the sort of thing they themselves could never have told me. One just sees why when one sees the three species together. Each of them is to the others both what a man is to us and what an animal is to us. They can talk to each other, they can cooperate, they have the same ethics. To that extent, a Sorn and a Hross meet like two men. But then each finds the other different, funny, attractive as an animal is attractive. Some instinct starved in us, which we try to soothe by treating irrational creatures almost as if they were rational, is really satisfied in Malachandra. They don't need pets. By the way, while we are on the subject of species, I am rather sorry that the exigencies of the story have been allowed to simplify the biology so much. Did I give you the impression that each of the three species was perfectly homogeneous? If so, I misled you. Take the Hrossa. My friends were black Hrossa, but there are also silver Hrossa, and in some of the western Handramits one finds the great crested Hross, 10 feet high, a dancer rather than a singer, and the noblest animal after man that I have ever seen. Only the males have the crest. I also saw a pure white Hross at Meldilorn, but like a fool, I never found out whether he represented a subspecies or was a mere freak like our terrestrial albino. There is at least one other kind of Sorn besides the kind I saw, the Sorrowborn, or Red Sorn of the desert, who lives in the sandy north. He's a corker, by all accounts. I agree, it is a pity I never saw the Fiffle Triggy at home. I know nearly enough about them to fake a visit to them as an episode in the story, but I don't think we ought to introduce any mere fiction. True, in substance, sounds all very well on Earth, but I can't imagine myself explaining it to Oyarsa. And I have a shrewd suspicion, see my last letter, that I have not heard the end of him. Anyway, why should our readers, you seem to know the devil of a lot about them, who are so determined to hear nothing about the language, be so anxious to know more of the Fiffle Triggy? But if you can work it in, there is, of course, no harm in explaining that they are oviparous and matriarchal and short-lived compared with the other species. It is pretty plain that the great depressions which they inhabit are the old ocean beds of Malachandra. Hrossa, who had visited them, described themselves as going down into deep forests over sand, the bone stones, fossils of ancient wave-borers about them. No doubt these are the dark patches seen on the Martian disk from Earth. And that reminds me, the maps of Mars which I have consulted since I got back are so inconsistent with one another that I have given up the attempt to identify my own Handramit. If you want to try your hand, the desideratum is a roughly northeast and southwest canal cutting a north and south canal not more than 20 miles from the equator. But astronomers differ very much as to what they can see. Now as to your most annoying question. Did Orgrey, in describing the Eldila, confuse the ideas of a subtler body and a superior being? No. The confusion is entirely your own. He said two things, that the Eldila had bodies different from those of planetary animals, and that they were superior in intelligence. Neither he nor anyone else in Malachandra ever confused the one statement with the other, or deduced the one from the other. In fact, I have reasons for thinking that there are also irrational animals with the Eldil type of body. You remember Chaucer's Airish Beasts. I wonder, are you wise to say nothing about the problem of Eldil speech? I agree that it would spoil the narrative to raise the question during the trial scene at Meldilorn, but surely many readers will have enough sense to ask how the Eldila, who obviously don't breathe, can talk. It is true that we should have to admit we don't know, but oughtn't the readers to be told that? I suggested to Jay, the only scientist here who is in my confidence, your theory that they might have instruments or even organs for manipulating the air around them and thus producing sounds indirectly, but he didn't seem to think much of it. He thought it probable that they directly manipulated the ears of those they were speaking to. That sounds pretty difficult. Of course, one must remember that we have really no knowledge of the shape or size of an Eldil, or even of its relations to space, our space, in general. In fact, one wants to keep on insisting that we really know next to nothing about them. Like you, I can't help trying to fix their relation to the things that appear in terrestrial tradition, gods, angels, fairies, but we haven't the data. When I attempted to give Oyarsa some idea of our own Christian angelology, he certainly seemed to regard our angels as different in some way from himself. But whether he meant that they were a different species, or only that they were some special military caste, since our poor old Earth turns out to be a kind of Ypres salient in the universe, I don't know. Why must you leave out my account of how the shutter jammed just before our landing on Malacandra? Without this, your description of our sufferings from excessive light on the return journey raises the very obvious question, why didn't they close their shutters? I don't believe your theory that readers never notice that sort of thing. I'm sure I should. There are two scenes that I wish you could have worked into the book. No matter, they are worked into me. One or other of them is always before me when I close my eyes. In one of them, I see the Malacandrian sky at morning, pale blue. So pale that now, when I have grown once more accustomed to terrestrial skies, I think of it as almost white. Against it, the nearer tops of the giant weeds, the trees, as you call them, show black. But far away, across miles of that blinding blue water, the remoter woods are watercolour purple. The shadows all around me on the pale forest floor are like shadows on snow. There are figures walking before me. Slender yet gigantic forms, black and sleek as animated tall hats. Their huge round heads, poised on their sinuous stalk-like bodies, give them the appearance of black tulips. They go down, singing, to the edge of the lake. The music fills the wood with its vibration, though it is so soft that I can hardly hear it. It is like dim organ music. Some of them embark, but most remain. It is done slowly. This is no ordinary embarkation, but some ceremony. It is, in fact, a Hras funeral. Those three with the grey muzzles whom they have helped into the boat are going to Meldilorn to die. For in that world, except for some few whom the Hnakra gets, no one dies before his time. All live out the full span allotted to their kind, and a death with them is as predictable as a birth with us. The whole village has known that those three will die this year, this month. It was an easy guess that they would die even this week. And now they are off, to receive the last counsel of Oyarsa, to die, and to be by him unbodied. The corpses, as corpses, will exist only for a few minutes. There are no coffins in Malacandra, no sextons, churchyards, or undertakers. The valley is solemn at their departure, but I see no signs of passionate grief. They do not doubt their immortality, and friends of the same generation are not torn apart. You leave the world, as you entered it, with the men of your own year. Death is not preceded by dread, nor followed by corruption. The other scene is a nocturne. I see myself bathing with Hjoi in the warm lake. He laughs at my clumsy swimming. Accustomed to a heavier world, I can hardly get enough of me under the water to make any headway. And then I see the night sky. The greater part of it is very like ours, though the depths are blacker and the stars brighter. But something that no terrestrial analogy will enable you to fully picture is happening in the west. Imagine the Milky Way magnified, the Milky Way seen through our largest telescope on the clearest night. And then imagine this, not painted across the zenith, but rising like a constellation behind the mountaintops, a dazzling necklace of lights, brilliant as planets, slowly heaving itself up till it fills a fifth of the sky, and now leaves a belt of blackness between itself and the horizon. It is too bright to look at for long, but it is only a preparation. Something else is coming. There is a glow like moonrise on the Harandra. Ahira, cries Hyoi, and other baying voices answer him from the darkness all about us. And now the true King of Night is set up, and now he is threading his way through that strange western galaxy and making its lights dim by comparison with his own. I turn my eyes away, for the little disk is far brighter than the moon in her greatest splendor. The whole Handramit is bathed in colorless light. I could count the stems of the forest on the far side of the lake. I see that my fingernails are broken and dirty. And now I guess what it is that I have seen. Jupiter, rising beyond the asteroids and 40 million miles nearer than he has ever been to earthly eyes. But the Malachandrians would say, within the asteroids, for they have an odd habit, sometimes, of turning the solar system inside out. They call the asteroids the dancers before the threshold of the great worlds. The great worlds are the planets, as we should say, beyond or outside the asteroids. Glundandra, Jupiter, is the greatest of these, and has some importance in Malachandrian thought which I cannot fathom. He is the centre, great Meldilorn, throne and feast. They are, of course, well aware that he is uninhabitable, at least by animals of the planetary type, and they certainly have no pagan idea of giving a local habitation to Maleldil. But somebody or something of great importance is connected with Jupiter. As usual, the Sironi would know, but they never told me. Perhaps the best comment is in the author whom I mentioned to you. For as it was well said of the great Africanus that he was never less alone than when alone, so in our philosophy no parts of this universal frame are less to be called solitary than those which the vulgar esteem most solitary, since the withdrawing of men and beasts signifieth but the greater frequency of more excellent creatures. More of this when you come. I am trying to read every old book on the subject that I can hear of. Now that Western has shut the door, the way to the planets lies through the past. If there is to be any more space travelling, it will have to be time travelling as well. This concludes the reading of Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. This book was read by Geoffrey Howard. If you would like to obtain a complete printed catalogue of our titles, or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write Blackstone Audio Books, Post Office Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.